Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM.
Hi, thanks for joining us for Alaska Edition. I'm Lori Townsend, your host this week. Michael Carey will return next week for next week's program. My guests today are KSKA Anchorage reporter Daisha Eaton, Frontiersman reporter Andrew Wellner covering Mat-Su Valley issues, and on Skype from Bethel, we are joined by KYUK's news director Angela Denning Barnes, who covers Bethel and other Southwest Alaska communities. Thanks for joining me today. Angela, let's start with you. The Board of Fisheries adopted a new salmon management plan for the Kuskokwim last week. Tell us about the major points of this plan and how it's being received in your area.
Well, the plan makes several significant changes, particularly to the subsistence fishery. It strengthens the subsistence language and directs managers to consider things like harvest trends before they would ever consider a commercial fishery. It establishes a drainage-wide escapement goal, something that never existed before, and it prevents subsistence closures in the future. Now, that's coming from new data from the State Department of Fish and Game. They've compiled 10 years worth of data, and they're saying that now we don't need as many king salmon to escape to get sustainable harvests. So in other words, smaller escapement numbers could actually bring back more salmon in the future, which would have a direct impact on subsistence closures and not needing them, such as we saw this past year. Another new change would be if closures are seen to be necessary, there's language in the new plan that would allow people 60 years of age and older to still fish if closures were implemented.
And how has that been received? Are you hearing from either the Association of Village Council Presidents or other community members about if this goes far enough in their minds?
Well, I think there is some skepticism out there, and that's just due to what people have seen in the past. Going into the board meeting, the Association of Village Council Presidents was kind of against lowering escapement goals. And they said that was because they've seen runs diminish in other drainages in the state, such as the Yukon River. But there are a lot of people on board. The working group, which is people that are in the industry, representatives from tribes up and down the Kuskokwim River, did support this. So, and the managers themselves, the state managers, feel very confident in this data, and they say it's pretty complex, but they're very confident in it. So generally, fishermen in the region are just going to start to learn about this. What the board actually approved and adopted over this past weekend, that information is going to be disseminated still throughout the region. So I think most people probably are just now starting to learn about it.
Catch us up a bit, Angela, on the fishermen who went out during closures last year, sort of defied the state and were cited. Nets were seized. There were, I believe, about 24 people that were given citations for fishing during the closure. There's been some trials. They haven't gone particularly well for those folks. They were fined. What's the status of those cases right now?
Well, they're still ongoing. There's 21 of the 24 fishermen that are still in court. So in the fall, they found the first three guilty, and they did have to pay fines. The Defenders, which is a pro bono group, the Northern Justice, I believe they're Northern Justice Center, but it's the attorney's name is James Davis Jr. In the beginning, they argued that the fishermen didn't know all of the changing regulations as they were happening. That was with the first three. And then it seems like now they've changed their strategy and they're going at it from a different angle with the last 21. They're saying they're trying to bring in Yupik culture experts to talk about constitutional rights and subsistence rights with the fishermen. Now, the latest is that the state is opposing a couple of those witnesses, and the trials are set now for April.
And one last thing, Angela, before I move on to my other guests here today. The relief bill that was put together for Hurricane Sandy at at first had some money in it for the fisheries disasters here on the Yukon and Kuskokwim. That money was taken out. What are you hearing about? Is there any legislation in sight or any word from the congressional delegation as to when these families may see some relief out there? And how are they faring?
Well, it seems like it's going to be taking some more time. It didn't make it into Sandy Bill, like you said. And so the next step could possibly be the appropriations process, but that will take some time. But when you look back at what took place before on the Yukon River, when they had salmon disasters there, that took place in 08 and 09. It wasn't declared a disaster until January 2010. And then funding didn't come through until the fall of 2010. So just kind of using that as an indicator, I think it's just going to take some more time. And I think the delegation still has hope that they can see something happen.
All right, thank you. Daisha, let's move on to Anchorage School Board District, the school district's financial situation. They need to cut more than $20 million. There's 200 jobs that are being cut. What are some of these positions that are being eliminated?
Most of them are, there are not any direct teaching positions that are set to be eliminated. They're all support positions, which means different sorts of teacher's aides, counselors, teaching assistants, a lot of clerical staff. 112 have already occurred, and the new, Dr. Browder, the new superintendent, he has tried to manage these cuts through attrition. So as people retire or leave the district, just leaving these positions unfilled. And he says he's committed to continuing to try to manage the cuts that way. He says in the end, although there's 217 positions set to be cut, there'll probably only be about 50 or 60 positions eliminated. And there was a big talk. I attended the school board meeting, the early school board meeting this week, and that's where most of the discussion now seems to be happening. It's kind of in the middle of the day. And the big discussion between the school board and Dr. Browder was about counselors, where a big bulk of people are set to be cut. And, you know, the school board, some people on the school board were saying, you know, we put all these counselors in place for a reason, because we have a lot of special populations, Alaska Native students. We have students that are struggling to even graduate from high school. We have graduation coaches and special counselors for these populations. And Dr. Browder was arguing more for having general counselors and cutting it down to people who just could kind of address everything, more generalists. So that'll be an interesting conversation that they'll be having over the next couple of weeks.
And what about special education, both support staff and teachers? How is that area going to be impacted in these cuts?
Well, when you look at the cuts, there are 49 cuts specifically to special ed, and those are special ed teaching assistants, I believe. But those are all unfilled positions that they've cut. So at this time, it doesn't look like there will be any more cuts to special ed, but it could happen. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Andrew, the Mat-Su Borough is shelling out a lot of money for a ferry that it can't use. What's happening with the MV Susitna? Are they attempting to sell it?
The sale is one option. They're looking for any option that would not necessitate them having to pay back the millions they've already spent. They built a ferry terminal out at Point McKenzie for passengers and whatnot. And if they just walk away right now, they're going to have to pay the federal government back all that money, and they don't have it. So there's ways to sort of transfer it to other government agencies. I mean, that's why the Marianas Islands came up pretty recently. The Marianas were looking at this as a way to get between two of their islands down there. That ended up not being very fruitful. The governor down there, I think, paid a pretty hefty political price for even discussing this without sort of consulting with some other folks in his government. But yeah, it's a pretty expensive kind of proposition to hold onto this boat without anywhere to
What does it cost them per month? I've heard some kind of alarming figures for it sitting at the dock each month.
Well, the last figure I reported was earlier this week, and I pegged it at $230,000,
per month?
No, that was a 3-month figure. Wow. And so you have to pull, and you had to pull off about 17,000 for lube oil and fuel. But just straight wharfage dockage fees, I came up with about 70 grand a month.
My goodness. And how did the cart sort of get so far in front of the horse with this ferry in the first place? They had a special ferry built, a fast ferry, and now it can't be used. What happened there?
Well, I think that, at least politically, the idea of a fast ferry is part of what kind of sunk it. You know, that boat can move faster than would be prudent in Cook Inlet. Like, if you put it at its sort of optimal speed, you wouldn't be able to stop it before you got to the other side.
Oh,
you'd be going too fast. So they have to run it, like,
there's an engineering problem there initially.
It's over-designed. You know, I mean, it's more boat than I think they needed. And that's what a lot of the new assembly members were saying. You know, a ferry might be a good idea, but not this ferry.
So at this point, it's just sitting, and they haven't quite decided what to do with it.
Yeah, they're trying to figure it out. And, you know, I can't quite pinpoint exactly where it all went south. You know, I started to see sort of dark clouds on the horizon when the borough was sort of squabbling with Anchorage about where are we going to put this thing. The borough wanted to land at Ship Creek. Anchorage has big plans for Ship Creek. They still do, actually. The most recent mayor said he'd like to develop it, but the one before him, Mark Begich, said the same thing. Mm. And the borough was like, no, we can't land it at the port because the port is a secure area. We can't have pastures going in and out of there. We need our own spot. I think with that kind of uncertainty, I mean, who's going to really give you a grant to build a dock, you know?
Mm. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future with that. Let's head back to rural Alaska again. Angela Denning Barnes on the phone with us from Bethel. The perennial problem of high fuel costs for rural Alaskans. We're heading into the most intense part of the heating season right now. What are the prices currently for fuel in the Bethel area and the surrounding villages? I know that the prices vary pretty dramatically in some of those places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we've been a little lucky because it hasn't been as cold this winter so far as it was last year, which is extremely hard on a lot of folks. Here in Bethel, we're seeing gasoline prices just over $7 a gallon at $7.06. Our heating fuel in Bethel is currently $6.50. Now, usually, as most people probably know, in the villages, it's more expensive because they're more remote. There, the gasoline is ranging from about $7 to $8 a gallon, some a little over $8 a gallon. And then the heating fuel is about $6 to $8 a gallon in the villages.
And are you hearing from families? We've kind of got this convergence of problems, both the poor salmon runs last year, people had a hard time getting enough fish for the winter, that coupled with these high prices. What kind of an impact is that having on families there?
Well, they're struggling. Certainly people have seen less dry fish at feasts. We just got through Slavic, which is the Russian Orthodox Christmas. I heard from folks who attended that there were just no dry fish presented in the feast there. So people are trying to eat other things. Luckily, there's a moose population on the lower Yukon, and the weather's been good enough for people in the Kuskokwim to travel up there to get meat. And then folks are also eating other fish that they can get in the ice over the winter. But you know, people are struggling. And I think, you know, in a place that has really high unemployment, they're used to struggling.
Mm-hmm. Dacia, Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, J-Bear recently restricted alcohol for Army personnel. What prompted this?
Well, it's unclear exactly what prompted it. They didn't pinpoint any specific incident, but they said there has been a large number of events or incidents, and common themes were suicide gestures, abuse, sexual assaults, and fights in the barracks. And they said the common themes are alcohol and drug use.
Mm-hmm. Is it just the Army side, or what about the Air Force side of things?
The Air Force is not instituting a ban. They actually already have one in the barracks. This is coming from the Army side.
Okay. There was a really strange event last Saturday night. Someone crashed a pickup I don't know if crash is the right word, but they went through the gate without authorization, drove around a bit on the base, and then got off without being caught. They were fired on, ended up in my neighborhood about three blocks away from where I live, and there was an arrest. Was that in any way related to this issue?
I asked specifically about that, and they told me no. Officials at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson said no, this had nothing to do with the ban on alcohol. And there was insinuation that this may have not actually been someone who was even associated with the military. We're waiting to hear more about that. I've been in touch with the investigator on base, and they're being very tight-lipped and not saying anything more about it. The FBI is involved, and investigators with Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. Andrew, in the valley, the Mat-Su Creamery has been closed down. The state pumped nearly $1 million into the operation to try to shore it up, but to no avail. What happened? It seems odd that with a city the size of Anchorage close by and a very rapidly growing population in the Mat-Su Valley that we can't support a local creamery. What's going on there?
It's one of those ones that kind of depends on who you talk to. When you talk to folks who were running the creamery and working there, they say that, you know, they were rushed into their startup and they ended up with a facility that didn't really fit their needs. Most recently, the septic system there has been basically failing. They've had to pump all their waste out of there, and that was costing them a lot of money and dragging them into the red. And they also were sort of pushed into having just too big of a facility. You know, they were using the old mat-made machines and processors and that sort of thing, and it was too much. They didn't have enough milk to sort of to make it economical to run those machines. But if you talk to, you know, dairy opponents, of which there are many, you know, they couldn't compete on price. The price from the lower 48, and if you don't do anything to set yourself apart, why would people pay the premium? Mm. And then they also kind of had a pretty bad reputation. They had a whole bunch of PR kind of disasters. You know, there was tainted product, there was product spoiling too fast, and there's the FBI, we now found out, was investigating one of their major shareholders, one of the guys who was sort of put up as the savior of the dairy industry, you know, and now he's facing federal charges.
So some quality control issues and also some legal issues. There's a longtime dairy farming family, the Havemeisters, have secured a federal loan, I believe it is, for a bottling operation. How will this work, and why would this have a chance of succeeding when the full-fledged creamery could not?
You know, and I'm not sure exactly where the money's coming from. It's the same as the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund with the state, but I don't know if that money came from elsewhere before.
Okay.
It was in the...
Okay, so it was federal dollars.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It could have been federal. When I talk to them, it seems pretty convincing that, you know, that they're a smaller operation. They don't have the overhead that the creamery had to deal with. They're just using their own milk, until recently, actually. Very recently, they said that they could take milk from other farmers, which was, I think, what a lot of people were waiting to see. And to keep it small, keep it simple. You know, the creamery started up with a whole line of products. You know, they had cheese, they had milk, they had cheese curds, they had yogurt. He's starting out with bottles and gallon jugs. And if he can make that go, he can maybe start thinking about expanding. But for now, he says he's making a go of it. He's selling all his milk, doing exactly what he needed to do to keep that farm going, which is what his goal was in the first place.
Good. Let's hope they can have some success with that. It seems like it would be good to have a local operation supplying product to us.
Just a local option, you know?
Absolutely.
If that's what you're looking for.
Dacia, the Inlet Inn in downtown Anchorage will close its doors on February 1st. The police were called to the property nearly 500 times in 2012 for drug and alcohol crimes, fights, other problems. There's already a shortage of temporary housing for transient and low-income people in the city. How many people will be displaced when this happens? And what, if anything, is in the works to try to help these newly homeless folks?
Well, I talked to the manager, and he said about half of the hotel's 80 or so rooms were full this week, and He said, you know, about 30 of those probably were long-term residents. He said some long-term residents had already packed up and gotten out to try to find other options. And what's being done, I talked with Catholic Social Services this week, and they said that they are coordinating some kind of outreach with the police department to let people know what their options are. But they also said that the bottom line is there's just not a lot, there are not a lot of options for folks to get into some sort of temporary supportive housing. But more importantly, I think these folks, a lot of them have issues. That's a, you know, a quote from the guy who managed the desk for 20 years. And there are a variety of issues, mental illness, disability, addictions. And there's really a lack of long-term supportive housing for people to find a community and a home to deal with those issues, where there are social service workers and organizations on site and paying visits to the location. So Catholic Social Services says they're working on that and trying to get funding for those sorts of options for people at the Inland Inn. What'll happen with these folks February 1st is unclear. They may go to Brother Francis Shelter. I talked with Catholic Social Services. They said the shelter is just below capacity. I mean, really, they said it was at 350 or something, and the limit's 360, and that includes the Beans overflow to Beans Cafe. If that gets full, then they'll put them at the public safety building, I believe, which is at the jail, which might not be a very inviting place for a lot of these folks to go.
Right.
So hopefully they won't be outside.
Mm-hmm. Will the property be cleaned up and used again, or are they going to tear it down? Is that known yet?
I talked with the developer, and he says that it's Mark Pfeffer. He says that it will be boarded up and it will be demolished by the end of the summer, most likely. And they originally applied for permits to make it into a 21-story office tower. He says that may still be an option, but they're exploring what the demand is.
Okay, thank you. Angela, I'm going to jump back to you again. Good jobs are always in short supply in rural Alaska, but there are some projects underway in your region right now that are providing some construction jobs. What's happening? What's going on out there?
You're right. There are several projects happening in Bethel coming up. This is going to be a very busy summer coming up for construction workers. We're looking at about 100 jobs in Bethel for these projects. And here's just a little list of them. There's a new nursing home assisted living center. There's a new pre-maternal home opening. So the nursing home assisted living center is supposed to open this year. The new pre-maternal home, the spring of 2014. New movie theater, two-screen movie theater, and a grocery store combined. That's supposed to open in 2014. And then a new rec center swimming pool is also supposed to open in 2014. And then a little beyond that, a couple other projects is a new dormitory for the Ute Litnavat Learning Center, which is a kind of a vocational technical school, and then a youth facility expansion. So these are some of the projects, but just, you know, with the opening dates happening this year and next year, 2014 is going to be a big year. A lot of construction here in Bethel. Bethel is the hub for 56 villages in the region, and we have about 6,200 residents currently in Bethel. So, you know, the town is definitely going to change when these things come on board.
Yeah, very exciting. Is it known how many permanent jobs this may result in? The construction jobs will be great, of course, for local people, but what about long-term jobs?
That's unclear. That's unclear what it's going to take, and then what's unclear and what some people are concerned about are operating funds that are going to be going along with all of these capital projects that we're seeing. So we'll have to wait and see about that.
Okay, thank you. Andrew, development of coal reserves in the Mat-Su is ramping up. It has divided residents there. What are the current proposals and the concerns that you're hearing?
Well, there's three that are kind of on the table that I've seen generating a lot of heat and a lot of debate. There's Usabelli. They were kind of the first into the mix, and their sort of lease area is just past Palmer. It's in the Buffalo Mine Soap, so it's not quite Sutton. The next one was Riversdale.
That's an Australian company, is
yeah,
that correct?
Yeah, Australian. And Theirs is a little further out, sort of Sutton-Chickaloon area. And then the latest one, and the most preliminary of all three of them, is the one near Squintna. And the state is looking into a best interest finding. They're going to decide if it's a good idea to lease this land for coal mining. But, you know, they decided to do that based on an industry inquiry. Somebody said, hey, we'd like to do this here. Do you think you can open up your lands?
Mm-hmm. I know that some of the meetings have been heated for a few of these proposals. People are worried about coal dust impacts on residential areas. What are you hearing now? Some folks, of course, want the jobs in an area that doesn't have a lot of jobs. The Sutton area has seen mining. That's kind of the part of the history of that area. So what are you hearing from residents in small communities? This can be a big dividing factor.
I see it as essentially a huge dividing factor. There's folks who grew up around coal mining who don't sort of lend a whole lot of credence to these ideas that, you know, the dust and such are dangerous. And then there's folks who don't want that in their backyard. Mm-hmm. I've talked to a lot of people who live essentially on the mine's rim, you know, and they don't want to see this happen.
Well, watch the progress. We're about out of time. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Wellner, Angela Denning Barnes, and Daisha Eaton. Michael Carey will be back next week. Thanks for tuning in.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.